You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Watford's Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And an unspecified European location's Daniel Freeb.
Thank you.
Daniel, you're actually, we know we can specify your European location today.
Why, because I filled out my whereabouts this week?
Or? Well, one hopes you always fill out your whereabouts. Put your computer on silent, please, Lionel.
Sorry.
Professionalism.
That was an important email arriving.
Anyway, here we are all together. Chaps, where are we, Lionel?
We're in Bar Italia, where we were last week, but with Daniel as well, all together, the three musketeers.
Daniel, nice to be back in Bar Italia, in the heart of Soho.
Fond memories.
Lots of memories.
Relatively fond memories. 10 years ago, exactly, almost, Mark Cavendish had a book launch in here, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
A happy event. What are we talking about this week? We've got Milan-San Remo, first monument. And any other news, Lionel?
There's lots of other news. Yeah, lots of other news. We're going to focus mostly on Milan-San Remo in this episode, won by Julian Alaphilippe of De Koninck Quick-Step. Their incredible run continues. An amazing final 6 kilometres of the race, the previous 285, not so much, but we'll talk about that.
That's kind of the point, though, isn't it?
That is kind of the point, yeah. But we'll discuss that in the first part and possibly into the second part.
We're also going to hear Brian Holm, an interview from 2014, the De Koninck Quick-Step sports director. Of course, Daniel remembered this interview he did with him 2014 about a young Julian Alaphilippe back then.
Nostradamus, Brian Holm.
Mm.
But the other racing news this week has been racing in Belgium and northern France. The Nokere Cursa was won by Case Boll of Sunweb. He out-sprinted Bora Hansgrohe's Pascal Ackermann on the cobbles. Jasper Philipsen, the 21-year-old UAE rider, was third, but there was a big crash in that finishing straight, which took out the Dutch champion, cyclocross star Mathieu van der Poel, and he looked pretty badly hurt, and initially there were fears that he'd perhaps broken bones, but hospital treatment determined that that wasn't the case. More of him in a moment. On Friday, there was the Bredene Coxeter Classic, previously the Hanzema Classic, and this is where Pascal Ackermann won ahead of Sky's Christopher Halvorsen and De Koninck Quick-Step's Alvaro Hodge. Ackermann, of course, will be Bora Hansgrohe's sprinter at the Giro d'Italia, we think, so an important win for him.
Hodge, some consolation there after Scotland's heavy defeat to Kazakhstan.
Indeed,
Hodge restoring some pride there.
Scotland losing in Astana.
Next item, please.
Next item was the Grand Prix d'Annan in northeastern France, a kind of mini Paris-Roubaix it's trying to rebrand itself as. Lots of cobbled sections. On one of those cobbled sections, Johan Afredo had a bad crash and was airlifted to hospital in Lille. Fortunately, he is on the mend. But the race was won by Mathieu van der Poel, who, well, he pretty much demolished it in the last sort of 20-30 kilometres. Quite incredible considering how hard he'd hit the deck only a handful of days earlier. He will now target some bigger cobbled classics as the spring goes on. The Trofeo Alfredo Binder Women's World Tour race was won by Marianne Vos for the fourth time, but the first time since 2012 that she has won. It was an absolutely humdinger of a finish. Everything came together right at the very end, and Vos beat Amanda Spratt, Cecily Utrip, Ludwig into second and third place respectively. You'll be talking about that as well as the rest of the Women's World Tour racing in the next episode of the Cycling Podcast Feminine, which will be out after the Tour of Flanders.
I think the day or so after the Tour of Flanders, yes.
Off the bike, or rather away from the racing, the UCI is going to ban corticosteroids by next season, apparently, following the ban on tramadol, which has recently come into being. We await full and final confirmation of that, but that is certainly the UCI president, David Lepartion's intention. The Tour de France wildcards have been finalised. Joining Wanty Group Gobert and Cofidis, who already had their wildcards, are Direct Energy, who have among their number Lilian Kalmajan, Nikki Terpstra and Ryan Taramay, and Arkea Samsic, who have Warren Barguil and Andre Greipel. Perhaps not too much of a surprise there. Fabio Aru is out of the Giro d'Italia. The former Vuelta champion is going to have iliac artery surgery. That's basically to treat a problem which I gather is blocking the flow of blood to his legs. So that may be the answer to Aru's patchy form over the last, 12 months. Is it his left leg?
Yeah.
So he's been pedalling on one leg, effectively.
Yeah. All right, if you're right-footed, isn't it?
I don't think being right-footed or left-footed influences cycling, does it?
No.
Not sure. And we'll discuss this a bit later in the podcast, but Gary Verity has left Welcome to Yorkshire. Verity was instrumental in bringing the Tour de France to Yorkshire in 2014 and creating the Tour de Yorkshire stage race and bringing the World Championships to Yorkshire later this year.
Absolutely, Lionel, if we can just backpedal on the issue of being right or left-footed. I think we once had a relatively heated debate about whether turning left was easier for someone who was right-handed or right-sided, right-side dominant. Mm. And you said there wasn't any difference, Rich. I seem to remember this.
I sort of have a vague memory of this debate.
Probably not a topic for today.
I can't remember what the conclusions were from that or the basis for the conclusions. Nothing particularly concrete or evidence-based, I don't think.
Excellent stuff. Does that fit into the news roundup?
More insight coming later.
Yeah, indeed.
But we will talk about the Gary Verity news. That could have quite serious repercussions for events like the Tour of Yorkshire, certainly.
Yeah, I should just add that Gary Verity's departure from Welcome to Yorkshire is amid allegations about his expenses claims. And also his conduct. So we'll discuss that a bit later on in the podcast.
The fastest clothing in the world tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Ratha in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Comfort and confidence is incredibly important. My name's Jimmy Whelan and I ride for EF Education First Pro Cycling. Obviously comfort comes first, but they also have to look good as well. And I think Rafa have nailed it this time around. You can tell there's a lot of research and development going into these bib shorts, both with the material of the panels and also the material of the chamois. The Rafa bib shorts are the best bib shorts in the world.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, Rafa. A reminder that they have just launched their new shoes, the Classic and Explore designs, created in-house following years of experience and research, tens of thousands of kilometers of wear testing as well, and the Classic shoe already been raced in the World Tour by Team EF Education First. I'm not sure if Alberto Bettiol was wearing his Rafa shoes on Saturday at Milan San Remo, but he certainly looked pretty impressive. He was one of the first outsiders to put in a meaningful attack on the Poggio and got a decent gap. And he's a very good rider. And actually, when I watched that, I thought, he's the sort of rider who could do well in a race like this. I remember he was third at Tour de France a couple of years ago, stage one, by Peter Sagan, the stage where he pulled his foot out on a sort of tough uphill finish.
Cost me a fiver, didn't he, though?
Didn't it?
On Saturday. Yeah.
On Saturday?
Well, I thought 50 to 1.
You had money on Bettiol.
Reasonable odds, but no.
You backed Bettiol.
I did.
Yeah.
Well, the new Rafa shoes, as they are available, they have the double wall lacing for a more comfortable fit. See rafa.cc for more information. And the latest EF Gone Racing film by Rafa is going to be out this week. That's at Milan San Remo. And they've got upcoming films from some of the Flanders races as well. Subscribe to Rafa Films on YouTube. So, Milan San Remo, let's hear from Brian Holm back in 2014. This was him speaking after the London Surrey Classic, which was one of the first races where some of us, anyway, were aware of Julian Alaphilippe. Just before we hear from Brian Holm on Julian Alaphilippe, let's travel back in time to 2014 and the three of us standing outside a pub in London. And it seems like an opportune moment. We've just been tweeted by our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio, who's on holiday and has been tweeting regularly from his Greek hideaway. And let's introduce Pedaleur de Charme.
And now Pedaleur de Charme.
Daniel, I think you've got a nomination for this.
Well, it's a young Frenchman, it has to be. Some things never changed. We're not at the tour anymore, but that trope remains. So Julien Alaphilippe was very active today, wasn't he? As Richard, you would say he animated the race. It's not a word that I enjoy.
I don't say that. Okay. You were complaining about that word earlier.
Yeah, I don't particularly like it. But anyway.
Lionel doesn't like made the junction.
Yeah. I hate that. It doesn't mean anything in any language.
Okay, Lionel. Back in your kennel. Alaphilippe rode very well today. I think did he get third in the end? But he is a young Frenchman we've not spoken much about. He's a former cyclocross rider, still rides cyclocross, very good in that discipline. He's been sort of snatched under the noses of the big French teams by Omega Pharma Quickstep. I think he was spotted by one of their soigneurs in Belgium, and he rode for their development team. He's a kind of punchy sort of sprinter, puncher. His father is an orchestra conductor. Bit of trivia for you. And I chatted after the race today with Brian Holm, his Omega Pharma direct sportif.
I think he would be the next big one in cycling. The way he's riding, you know, he's like a bit of Jelly Bear style. You know, he can climb, he can sprint, he can basically do everything. He got character, and for sure he's going to win his races sooner or later. He isn't a roller, but like something between a climber and a sprinter. He's climbing like maybe more like a Gilbert style. He can go unbelievable fast on them small climbs, and even survive climb out to like 10 kilometers, you know. And then I think he's going to win punch sprint, and maybe not punch sprint, but like out of 50 riders like Gilbert. He can place himself, and mentally he's a little bit crazy, a little bit like Cavendish, you know. So it's quite good for he got ambitions, he's greedy, you know, like
crazy in a good way, temperamental sort of.
When I say crazy with love in my heart.
Alaphilippe with third in London that day behind, do you remember who were first and second?
Adam Blythe won the race.
Ben Swift was second for Team Sky.
He was very matter of fact, wasn't he, Brian Holm, in 2014, about the fact that Julien Alaphilippe was going to be the best rider since Eddie Merckx.
Yeah, I mean, he does champion his riders, doesn't he, Brian Holm? But Alaphilippe has developed since then. We sort of became aware of his personality as well at the Tour de France a couple of years ago. But, I mean, this year, the way he's come out, you know, he's kind of carried on where he left off last year. If you remember, he was obviously had an amazing Tour de France, went straight from that one, San Sebastian. And it's his versatility. I mean, we didn't talk about it a great deal last week, but he won a bunch sprint at Tirreno Adriatico, effectively. And the way that he won on Saturday, I was struck by the comments of the runner-up, Oliver Nassen, and indeed Michał Kwiatkowski, who both said that, you know, that the best man won, that he deserved to win. He was the strongest on the Poggio, and he was the strongest in the finale. And, you know, he led it out a good old distance and was clearly just the strongest, I mean, against guys who you might have expected to beat them in the sprint.
Yeah, I mean, he's a swashbuckling rider, isn't he? I called our little triumvirate, the Three Musketeers, at the start of the podcast. No one picked up on that, but
didn't even hear that.
What's the matter with your brain today, Richard? you've forgotten everything. But Alaphilippe, I mean, he looks like he could play D'Artagnan from the Three Musketeers, doesn't he? He's got the moustache and the dark eyes and the dark hair, and he's got charisma. He's flamboyant, and when you look at what he's done so far this season, he won a couple of stages at the Vuelta a San Juan, stage at the Tour of Colombia. He won Strada Bianca. He won two stages at Tirreno Adriatico, one kind of over at the top of a climb, and one in a sort of a bunch sprint. But he had everyone's number in that bunch sprint. And I said last week that catapulted him up the list of potential winners for Milan-San Remo. But I didn't expect him to actually win it in perhaps the manner that he did, because at the finish he found himself in that group of, well, amazing riders, really. And the breadth of skill in that group had Alaphilippe, of course. You had former world champions Michał Kwiatkowski and Peter Sagan, former world cyclocross champion Wout van Aert, Grand Tour winners Alejandro Valverde and Vincenzo Nibali, Tom Dumoulin chasing on, the European road race champion Matteo Trentin. I mean, there was every single base was covered in that finish.
Well, a question on that, because for me the fastest finisher in that group was Trentin, I would have thought, and yet he attacked, and I don't know why he did exactly.
Well, it's the second year in a row. Same,
but last year he had Caleb Ewan there.
Yeah,
at least,
but it's the second year in a row when he sort of stuffed up the finale. I mean, I think think
and he was caught just I watched this again today. He was caught at exactly the same point both years, 1.3 kilometers to go. It came to an end for him. So I don't know why he's, I don't know why he tried it last year, because he wasn't the protected sprinter last year in his team. Whereas, you know, he in that position, that in that sort of scenario, he had a really good chance, I would have thought, of winning that sprint.
Do you think he choked then?
I think there was a bit of panic because there wasn't that much cohesion in that group, and it did look as if somebody took a flyer, they might just clip off. I mean, because the others were going to look at each other.
I think he was probably intimidated by some of the names and reputations in that group. He, of course, he's a rider with a very strong palmarès, but he hasn't won a monument, and he's still sort of on the brink, isn't he, as far as the biggest races are concerned. But it was probably the wrong decision. Easy to say with hindsight, though, isn't it? You know, we talked before, and I noticed in the interviews after the race, I think Matt White, Trentin's director sportif, talked about the fact that if anyone had hesitated, then it would look like an ingenious move. They didn't. And it was a shame because he looked as though he had the legs. He went away at a good old clip.
I think from a group of five or six or four or five, that could have worked. But a group of 10, that was a long odds bet, particularly when he's as quick in the finish as he is. I mean, easy for us to say, have confidence in his sprint. But like you say, Rich, who is undoubtedly... Well, who's on a par with him? Really only Sagan. And there's question marks about Sagan's form because of his illness. I mean, it was a mistake from Trentin, but that is amplified by the fact that it's the same thing 2 years running.
I think the absolutely fascinating thing about the last few minutes, as you said, Napalm, in Milan San Remo, is that no one knows what decisions they're going to have to make. They just know that they're going to have to make decisions in a very, very short space of time. And it's kind of like
Brexit, isn't it?
Well, it always strikes me as it's kind of like when you play Tetris and all of a sudden things start going faster than you're ready for, and everything is sort of literally falling down at a pace that you're not comfortable
and
with.
And you've left some horrible gaps on the left-hand side.
Exactly. And no one has been thinking about what they're going to do in the sprint for the previous 20 kilometers. They're presented with a set of circumstances that they're not ready for, and they just have to make the best of what those circumstances are. And I think that maybe explains why, for example, Peter Sagan has been in the shakeups every year since 2012, and there have been a couple of years when people have been off the front, but he's been in the mix, and he's got it wrong every single time. And it's almost as though he has a plan, and he thinks he knows what he's going to do when he gets onto Via Roma, but I don't know whether it doesn't suit his eye, that finish line, or whether he's just not really able to compute all the different options he has in that split second.
What's your Tetris playing tactic? Because as soon as it's not perfect and everything's all filled in and nice, I kind of give up. And I think maybe there's an element of that with Peter Sagan.
There you go.
what was your analysis of the Poggio itself? Because somebody reminded me on our Facebook discussion group actually about the Trentin attack last year. So I watched the finale from last year, and it was really interesting to compare this year and last year, because last year Barry Merida set up for Nibali in the same way that De Koning Quickstep did this year for Alaphilippe. I mean, De Koning Quickstep rode a fantastic race and really did a brilliant job for Alaphilippe. But there was a moment when Stibar swung off and Alaphilippe didn't go. And I wonder if he left a little bit too late, because Nibali went earlier last year, about around the time that Bettiol went, I think, roughly. And it's interesting, the other day I met Juan Antonio Fletcher, the former classics rider who was a teammate for many years of Oscar Freire, who won Milan-San Remo many years. And he was talking about Milan-San Remo and saying that Freire used to always say that there was the most difficult thing about Milan-San Remo is that the game for 6 hours is to really not expend any energy, to really just ride within yourself. And so when you get to the Poggio, the Cipressa maybe, but even the Poggio, you don't actually know if you're tired or not, and you don't know until you make an effort what you're capable of. It's a kind of, there's a moment in the race where the moment comes and you find out if you've got the legs or not. And Frere used to say there was a particular moment on the Poggio where no matter what was happening in the race, you had to make a big effort at that point. And it was the steepest point on the Poggio, about a kilometre and a half or so from the summit. And that was his game plan. It wasn't to do with what anybody else was doing. It's just you make an effort at that point, and that's when you find out how your legs are. And I thought that was really interesting. But it seemed to me that the moment for Alaphilippe to attack, it went a wee bit. And eventually he did go, he chased after other riders. But I wonder if there was a moment there where he could have forced a more of a selection going over the top. He won it, so it's a kind of pointless discussion. But he was clearly the strongest in the race. And by arriving at the finish in such a big group, he might not have won it. I mean, we're, you know, I'm asking you to imagine that he didn't win it, and asking you to imagine, or to I'm asking you whether you think he perhaps missed an opportunity to attack a bit earlier on the climb.
I think what all the riders said was the, and what we saw with the times, is the Cipressa was ridden very easily, and that was always likely to lead to a very fast ascent of the Poggio, which it was, I think, was the fastest since 1995. So I think in order to get away, you look at the riders who did get away, people had to do it almost with raw kind of speed and punch. Last year, it had been quite a rainy day, I think, in the first half, and it had been a much harder race, so Nibali was kind of able to use that attrition. That probably helped him in the end, whereas this time it really was a game of speed to get away, wasn't it?
It was, and I also wonder, you know, with De Koenig Quickstep having every base covered, which Stibar was doing a lot of work, but Gilbert did work as well, but, you know, it's not a rider that you could count out. He could still have played a role in the finale. But having Elia Viviani as well, at one point on the Poggio, you had Alaphilippe pressing on at the front, and it looked for a while like Viviani was just trying to hang tough a la Cavendish from a few years ago. Clearly wasn't going to get back up to the front because of the splits that happened. And in a way, you know, Alaphilippe had to force that split to happen. And so it had to. It wasn't necessarily about going early. It was about going and making sure that it stuck. I think he probably would have been quite relieved to see the identity of the riders coming across to him, you know, being packed with so much power, that then once they're over the top, we know how hard it is to close up gaps on the descent of the Poggio, and then it all comes down to what is that gap between the front riders and then the chasers as they come off the Poggio onto the flat road, where of course the speed gets sapped, and then it becomes about that again is another change of pace, isn't it? Because you've been going up, that's one type of effort, going down, that's another type of effort, a lot of concentration involved, and then onto that flat, it must be like sort of having a parachute open up behind you, and suddenly your legs have got to do all the work again. So I thought Alaphilippe played it absolutely perfectly. He got the gap and then finished it off. I mean, there was no sense of panic in that sprint, was there? He had everybody where he needed them to be, which was behind him.
I think he messed it up, Lionel. I mean, you can still get your tactics wrong even if you won. Just like you can win with bad tactics. Just like you can lose with the best tactics.
Of course. I'm staggering argument. I'm floored by this argument.
Okay. But nevertheless, it was a bigger group than probably we might have expected going over the top. Who was the biggest surprise in that group?
Purely objectively, Simon Clark, really.
Well, he wasn't in the group, was he? He caught back on the descent.
Oh, do you mean the ones that just
went over the
just
top of
over
the Poggio?
The top on the Poggio. Well, I mean, I don't know whether you could say any of them were a surprise. That's what I said at the start. There was so much pedigree in there. I mean, I was a little surprised Oliver Narsen was in there. Because, you know, he's somebody you associate much more with the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, but, you know, he's a classics rider, the distance wouldn't daunt him. I mean, it was, you know, the front group and the ones chasing back on, there was not a dud in there, was there? That was what made it so exciting. And, you know, we talk about Milan-San Remo being this sort of thrilling, short denouement, but it was 6.3 kilometres of brilliant racing. And if you could go back and watch it almost in slow motion and pick up every detail, it's worth watching a second or a third time.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast, team car, the back of the pack, please.
Well, we interrupt this week's program. Well, Seb Piquet, the voice of race radio at the Tour de France, interrupts this week's show to tell you that the episode this week is sponsored by The Economist. The Economist, of course, the smart guide to the forces impacting your world. It's about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from world politics and business to science, technology, arts, the environment, and even sport. It helps readers prepare for what is going on in the world around them, sifting through the noise, focusing on the essential information that tells the real story at a time when facts matter more than ever. The Economist has been a trusted source of intelligence for over 170 years, and it's for the kind of person who never stops asking questions and wants to know why the world is the way it is. Lionel, you have been sifting through your Economist, and have you found a story for us?
Well, I've found lots of things, Rich, because the thing that always impresses me about The Economist is that there's so many little nuggets that I pick up. I feel smarter having read it. So, for example, this week there was a story about Britain's tower blocks, which says that once they were symbols of poverty and now they very much symbols for the rich. And I learned that the tower block that was used as the exterior for the Trotter family's flat, Nelson Mandela House, was in fact a tower block in Acton, which is earmarked for demolition. And from the story,
you should explain
on,
that's Only Fools and Horses, of course.
That is Only Fools and Horses, the greatest sitcom ever made. And I learned that London has only 360 buildings of 20 stories or more. It's quite a low-rise city in sort of global terms, but that another 540 high-rise blocks are in the pipeline, and most of these buildings are not housing for ordinary people, but they are kind of totemic structures for the rich. Then I kind of turn a few pages and I read about our relationship with calories and how that might be completely wrong, not in the sense that the science is inaccurate, but that food packaging might be wrong and that two items of food with the same calorific values may be digested in different ways, and so people may put on more or less weight accordingly. I also learned about the late 16th century Italian physician called Santorio Sanctorius, who invented a weighing chair, and he sat dangling in this chair to weigh himself, everything he ate and drank, and all his urine and other waste for 30 years. And after doing this experiment for 3 decades, he answered very few of his own questions about the impact of the food and drink that he ate. And finally, there's a story about the logo on the bottles of San Pellegrino drinking water, which we've been enjoying here at Bar Italia. You'll probably notice it's a red star, and according to researchers at Oxford University, this may give San Pellegrino an edge over its rivals, because apparently people associate angular shapes with carbonated and bitter drinks, whereas they assume more rounded shapes will be still water or sweet drinks. I'm not sure whether that's true, but it did make me wonder what people think when they see the Cycling Podcast logo. Anyway, I feel smarter about just those three things from reading The Economist this week.
Well, The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. So if you've never stopped asking questions, you can get a free copy if you're a listener to the Cycling Podcast. Just text the word cycling. I'm not going to spell it out like Lionel sometimes does. Text the word cycling to 78070. That's cycling to 78070 to get your free print copy of The Economist.
It took a while to get going, didn't it, Milan Sanremo? But when it did, it was a real thrilling finish. But there were other things that caught my eye, certainly, in the preceding couple of hundred kilometres. The 10-man break that got 10 minutes had 4 Novo Nordisk riders in it. They obviously were keen to be represented in significant numbers in that break. And Bardiani had 2 riders in there as well, including Mirko Maestri, who has ridden Milan-San Remo 4 times and has been in the break every single time. But they were never going to stay away. And then it all comes down to the 3 capi, doesn't it? The 3 climbs that precede the Cipressa.
Just in terms of, Rich, what you were saying about Freire and conserving energy, and it's something that Mark Cavendish was a point that he stressed as well, that every single thing that you do in Milan-San Remo from the moment you start matters, in the sense that it's an expenditure of energy, and that's what you have to avoid. But it was just interesting to watch different approaches of teams on the Capi. Some of them were visibly stressed and anxious about maintaining the right position and staying in formation and getting their lead aware. He should be. I noticed that De Koninck weren't particularly, or they certainly had a bit more of an ad hoc approach to it, with different riders in different positions on the road. But you know, you look at some of the interviews and read some of the interviews after the races, Or after this race, and you get someone like Dylan Groenewegen saying, oh, you know, I've figured out now that I can definitely win Milan-San Remo. But you kind of imagine that, or he might feel like that, because ultimately he was still in touch on the Cipressa. But there's a big difference between, okay, being in touch on the Cipressa and even at the bottom of the Poggio, and getting to the other side and having a chance to win it. And some of those guys had obviously spent too much energy. And
well, yeah, I mean, you mentioned Groenewegen, and he was at the back on the Cipressa, which, I mean, the pace on the Cipressa was not significant, was it? Astana were doing quite a bit of work on the kind of first half of the climb, but then there was a point where it just fanned out all the way across the road. And I think probably because the break had been caught, Fausto Masnada was the last rider to be caught, and he was brought in just before the bottom of the Cipressa. And so, well, when Bonifazio of Direct Energy took a flyer on the descent of the Cipressa, it looked like perhaps the bunch were going to pay for just taking it a little bit too easy. It felt to me like if a couple could have got across to that, that might have made a winning move, because Bonifazio is no slouch. And I mean, his descent was, to use the mangled word I coined last week, it was an eye-boggling descent. There were moments where he was right on the back of the TV motorbike, or certainly one of the race motorbikes, and that motorbike had to pull over and let him go by, because he was keeping Bonifazio from descending at the rate he wanted to. But as I said before, that sense of when you come off those descents, having a parachute open out behind you, those roads are lovely and smooth but completely flat. I don't know what the wind was doing at exactly that point on the flat, but suddenly you've got to make effort again. And with all the firepower on the front of the peloton, it's no surprise that they're all back together again for the Poggio. And the Poggio, in contrast to the Cipressa, was raced hard and fast from the bottom.
And you say the firepower on the front line, or you know, this issue of the smaller teams, the seven-man teams, the last couple of years. I think that, like everything in Milan-San Remo, the difference is very subtle, but I certainly think that when the peloton gets onto the Poggio now, the teams, well, what they have left in terms of men and numbers, it all looks very fragile, and a team can look as though it's in pretty good shape, and then from one moment to the next, all of a sudden they're all gone, or all the members of that team are all over the road, and you get anarchy at the end. And it's quite a shock and a big difference from some of the Milan-San Remo, certainly in the mid-90s, when you did used to get teams that were pretty well organised on the other side of the Poggio. When Eric Zabel was winning multiple San Remos in a row, it had started to look like a Grand Tour sprint stage, but it doesn't look like that at all now.
And the pace on the Poggio, and the way that you can turn a strong position can suddenly turn into a weak one if you're just not careful. And this backs up what you were saying about Fletcher, Richard. It was Alberto Bettiol who made the first kind of significant looking move, but of course once the break went clear of seven, Bettiol wasn't even in it. That just shows how deep he had to go just to get off the front. And then by turn, that also shows just how strong Alaphilippe was to react, go straight past Bettiol, and then force, you know, the biggest names in the race to chase him. And just to turn the question round on you, Rich, you asked who was the most surprising in those seven: Sagan, Kwiatkowski, Naasen, Valverde, Trentin, and Wout van Aert. Presumably, you thought Wout van Aert was a surprise.
Yeah, and Naasen to some extent, although he rode a very good Paris-Nice, and I think he looks in great shape ahead of the, you know, the classics coming up. Tour of Flanders would be his race. You've interviewed him as well, Lionel Oliver Naasen. He comes across very well, and I posted a picture of him last year after Kern Brussels Kern, where he was walking away from his team bus, to obviously going home for the night, and just walking among the fans. Nobody recognised him. It was so cold. He was really wrapped up, but he had his suitcase and he was absolutely loaded down with kind of luggage. And I just thought it was an interesting picture of a, you know, a pro cyclist after the race going home for the night. And he has always struck me as a very down to earth sort of guy. Came to it quite late, didn't he, cycling, so he's known kind of what real life is like as well.
Indeed. But Van Aert, we've talked about his potential in the Cobble Classics, and with Van der Poel winning a race at the just before the weekend, or just at the weekend, sorry. Really interesting to see how these two cyclocross riders are translating into, you know, transferring across to the road. I mean, there's a significant difference between an effort for an hour and an effort for, in this case, Milan-San Remo, 6 hours, 40 minutes. And, well, Van Aert, I wouldn't have necessarily thought would be up there, but Daniel, I mean...
Well, I hadn't finished. I was going to say Van Aert was the biggest surprise, yeah, I think.
Well, and Lionel, I talked last week about this issue of debutants often going quite well in Milan-San Remo. So if someone was to finish one of the other monuments in sixth place at their first attempt, you would say, well, that's a future winner. I don't necessarily think we can look at Van Aert's result here and say, yeah, but it's a guarantee that he's going to win Milan-San Remo in the future. But he's certainly got the attributes too. Well, be at home in that exalted company of, you know, the best classics riders in the world, as he was at the weekend. What did you make of Kwiatkowski in the finale?
Well, he came from a long way back. He was really out of position coming into the sprint. And it was an odd one because Sagan sort of ended up leading it out, didn't he? And again, he did sort of make a mess of it, a bit like when he came into the finish with Kwiatkowski and Alaphilippe, and you would have expected him to have won that sprint, and he just lost it. This time too, he wasn't in the best position for the sprint, and Kwiatkowski managed to just slip up the inside and get himself onto Alaphilippe and Sagan, which were the right wheels to follow, and Nassen as well. And it opened up for Kwiatkowski a little bit, didn't it? So you know, it kind of it looked like he rescued it a little bit, but you know, I just, of all the people in that group, I just Alaphilippe is obviously in extraordinary form, but to win and to win in the way that he did from so far out, I did find that surprising. I thought, you know, as per my earlier analysis, I thought he'd kind of blown it a little bit.
Don't you think though that they would have all, with whatever 400 metres, 500 metres to go, when Sagan found himself on the front, they must have been thinking, this is perfect for us. Ordinarily, you would think Sagan would be one of the few riders who would be able to lead it out and see it through, but with his problems with sickness in Tirreno Adriatico, you know, uncertain how close to his absolute peak he was. So I'm coming round to your point of view, actually, Rich, now I think about it. Maybe, but Kwiatkowski, you know, it was there for him, and he didn't have the legs, whereas Alaphilippe did. So maybe Alaphilippe just felt like he was on one of those days, as he has been half a dozen times already this spring.
I think, Lionel, you said that you'd be interested to go back and watch the race almost from the start in order to sort of dissect everyone's individual performances and also their energy expenditure. I suspect if you went back and looked at, you know, for example, Peter Sagan's onboard camera, I don't know if he had one, or if you had, you know, the equivalent of the old, they used to have on Sky Sports
player
football
cam.
Coverage player cam.
Yeah.
It would actually. I'm not volunteering for this if such a thing does exist. But it would be interesting to go back and look at all of the sort of top tens races. And you know, with Sagan, he's a kind of, even the way he rides and moves in the peloton is fairly flamboyant. I just wonder whether there would be clues if you watched the Peter Sagan Milan-San Remo as to why on Via Roma he doesn't seem to get out the watts that he would usually get out.
What about Vincenzo Nibali, talking about extravagant efforts on the Cipressa? He was just about the only rider to do anything when he went from the left-hand side of the road to the right to try and grab a bottle. I mean, that effort presumably cost him on the Poggio and at the finish.
I was impressed by Nibali, though, because I think I said last week he hasn't looked to be in great form, but yet he was there, you know, ghosting into that move eventually. And Valverde as well, you know, was somebody who just slipped into it. And I think so much of it, and especially that running into the Poggio and on the Poggio itself when it's so quick, is about positioning. And Valverde is obviously a very clever rider, but Nibali and Valverde, they were just there, weren't they? And Dumoulin, we haven't mentioned Dumoulin, but Dumoulin did his usual trick of just kind of plugging away and coming back. And when he got onto that group, I wondered for a moment whether he'd have learned from the World Championship where he caught the group and then took a breather, whether he might have just
gone
past them.
Yeah. Well, just on Nibali, Bahrain Merida were the only team to have two riders in as it all kind of coalesced together. They had Mohoric in there as well, and they didn't really link up too well. And Mohoric made a move, and perhaps that was the moment for him to go. He, you know, again, a rider who's got a fast finish that's probably the moment for him to try something at a better point than Trentin had already tried.
Crucially, how many of your 18 favourites from Milan San Remo finished in the top 18?
Oh, I think 18, as I recall, Richard, about 18, 17 maybe.
Did you have Marco Haller and Mike Turnison in the top 18? I don't think you did. Them. They were 17th and 18th. Names. I think this is...
Anyway, chaps, should we talk about something else?
Where did the first Astana rider finish at the weekend?
It was Magnus Cort in 15th place.
Not a great day for Astana, then.
Well, considering Alexei Luksenko, who was your outside tip for the race, didn't pin on a number for Milan-San Remo, they did all right.
Ivan Garcia Cortina was my other outsider, but he wasn't riding either. So yeah,
and I didn't have Michael Matthews. I for some reason convinced myself that Michael Matthews was out injured, but he rode pretty well in the end.
Before we carry on, fellas, I should mention the second in the Adam Blythe interviews series goes out this week. He is in conversation with Luke Rowe. Have you listened to that one yet?
I have. Yeah.
Yeah. Interested.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
That was good. It was at the Tour Down Under. Since when, of course, Luke Rowe's been riding, well, he rode very well at Pyrenees, and I imagine will be one of the favourites going into Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix. But it's a really interesting sort of look back on his life in cycling. They met when they were about six for the first time. They've been racing together since they were about 6 or 7 years old, which is amazing. And quite a lot of detail, which I didn't know about Luke Rowe's recovery from his terrible accident a couple of years ago on his brother's stag do, where he broke his leg or smashed his leg, and also I didn't know that he was almost signed or certainly offered a contract by Quickstep before he signed for Team Sky, and that does lead you to wonder how his career might have panned out differently had he joined Quickstep and had more of a classics focus.
I don't do stag do's, do you? I don't. I gave them up.
What are you?
Not because of Luke Rowe, but it's probably a wise decision.
So if you were invited on a stag do, you wouldn't go?
I just said, it's a very easy get out for me because I said, no, I'm sorry, I don't do that.
Policy.
It's a policy.
Oh, wow. Who has a stag do policy, honestly? I pick and choose. I mean, if we're going to a medieval fort, I'd go. If it's just, you know, mindless drinking all weekend, I wouldn't go.
Well, I'm glad we cleared that up. Anyway, episode 2 in the Adam Blythe interviews series is out this week. Last week's was with Caleb Ewan, and it's a 6-part series. And he's met some and interviewed some interesting people, Adam Blythe. So that will be coming out on the normal feed in the normal places on your cycling podcast channel. So that's coming out. We've also got a special coming up, haven't we, as well?
We have, with the De Koninck Quickstep boss, Patrick Lefevre. That will be out. Duly.
Imminently.
Imminently, yeah.
Are we not talking like next week, just before Tour of Flanders?
Yes, it would certainly be before the Tour of Flanders, yes. But it's not quite finished. It's not being polished into near perfection yet.
So that's for friends of the podcast.
Yeah.
If you're not already a friend, sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. Lionel's conversation with Patrick Lefevre. The team of the moment, really, aren't they? And what was impressive, I mean, just returning briefly to Alaphilippe, because 26 years old now, what will he do now? Will he take a little break before the Ardennes, will he come back for Amstel Gold Race and obviously Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège?
He said at the weekend that while one might expect his biggest goals to be the Ardennes Classics actually this year, they were concentrated in this first part of the season. So basically the races he's won, Milan-San Remo, Strade Bianche and Tirreno. That said, I fully expect him to be right up there in the Ardennes now.
I would have thought so. I mean, those races are even more selective than, well, certainly more selective than Milan-San Remo. I mean, I'd just like to pose a question. Everyone's talking about whether Philippe Gilbert could win all five monuments. Paris-Roubaix is missing. Milan-San Remo is missing. Not many more chances for Gilbert to get those two races. But what about Alaphilippe? Could he win? I mean, he's sure, you know, he certainly could win Liège-Bastogne-Liège and Ile-Lombardia at some point in his career. If you can win those two, you can win the Tour of Flanders. The one that maybe there'd be the question mark over would be Paris-Roubaix. Daniel, you're...
It's a stretch, Napalm. If you can win in Lombardia, you can win the Tour of Flanders. Where are the peer-reviewed studies that prove that?
Philippe Gilbert has won Lombardia and the Tour of Flanders. Lots more riders have won those two races than have won Paris-Roubaix and Liège.
There aren't a huge number in recent years. I mean, okay, Michele Bartoli is one that comes to mind, but not too many in recent years.
But physically, surely.
I ask you...
If you can win Milan-San Remo, does that not give you a chance at Il Lombardia, or is Il Lombardia too hard?
I think in Alaphilippe's case, he can and probably will win Il Lombardia at some point. But Paris-Roubaix, might go down the same route as my Kwiatkowski fast, slow twitch muscle fibres.
Which you got away with.
Which I got spectacularly wrong.
Sagan prediction.
But Lionel, Julian Alaphilippe weighs, 62 kilos, did we say,
62
Rich?
62 kilos.
Has anyone that light ever even got close to winning Paris-Roubaix? I would suggest not.
You're asking...
I would be shocked if anyone in the last 30 years... underneath 70 kilos has won Paris-Roubaix. I think we've looked this up before. We've tried to establish this before.
When was that? Bernard Hinault was not 70 kilos, surely. He won Paris-Roubaix.
He was like 68
or something. 70 kilos.
I mean, there's some beefy old riders on that list, isn't there? It's a stretch to think Alaphilippe could win Paris-Roubaix, but in that team, you wouldn't rule out the impossible, surely.
It actually says on Wikipedia that Eno was 62 kilos. No, I find that hard to imagine. He wasn't as wiry or as slight as Alaphilippe. I find that very, very difficult to imagine. But, you know, could be wrong. Has the sport not changed, though, and become more specialised since then? You know,
all the more reason why
exactly
he won't
so,
do it.
Yeah, so it's a different game in a lot of ways, I think, now. But I mean, certainly where are Alaphilippe's limits? Paris-Roubaix, but what else? I mean, a lot of people asking about him as a King of the Mountains last year at Tour de France, winner of a couple of stages. What's stopping him performing in a Grand Tour?
I think his recovery, isn't it? His ability to put consecutive mountain stages together. He can do it for two or three days, but hasn't shown that he can do it for even in the mountainous 1 week stage races yet. He's tended to come a cropper. I think he'll win the polka dot jersey next year and for probably several years thereafter, because the name King of the Mountains is a bit of a misnomer, as we know, in the Tour de France. Now, it's essentially an uphill sprint competition, and he's perfect for that.
I'm going to agree with you here, because if you look back at his Tour de France last year, where he won a stage, on the face of it, you go, well, he won a stage in the Alps at Le Grand Bornand, and then a week later, he won a stage at Bagnères de Luchon in the Pyrenees, and in between that, he was second at Mond. And so you would say, well, that's the level of consistency required. But the key thing here is that stage after he won at Le Grand Bornand, the two stages after, to La Rosière and Alpe d'Huez, he was, way down, mid-pack, 84th and 100th. Effectively days off, really, for a rider of his calibre. So he wasn't racing at the sharp end on consecutive days. And you're absolutely right. That's another level up from the sort of performances we've seen from Alaphilippe so far. It's a bit of a stretch to think he could win a Tour de France.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their ongoing support of the Cycling Podcast. It is very much appreciated. And you can still get 25% off all your Science and Sport products, your gels and drinks and bars and so on. Go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. scienceandsport.com. Please keep your questions coming for the Science and Sport experts. You can leave us a voice message on WhatsApp at +44 7971 338 205. That's +44 7971 338 205. A voice message, please. Or email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. That's contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. We are skipping a week this week just for various practical reasons, but we'll return next week with the experts' answer to your latest questions. But as I say, keep them coming. And thank you once again to Science and Sport for their support. So the other news over the weekend was that of Gary Verity, Sir Gary Verity, who has become well known in the cycling world through, and originally through, bringing the Tour de France to Yorkshire in 2014, forging a great kind of relationship, friendship with Christian Prudhomme, the tour director. The Tour de Yorkshire was a legacy of that Grand Départ in Yorkshire, and he will also, well, he's played a big part in bringing the World Championships to Yorkshire as well. Friday evening, there was a statement put out by Welcome to Yorkshire, the tourism company in Yorkshire that Gary Verity has been the chief executive of, saying that he had resigned. And it mentioned in the statement that there had been some questions over expenses and inappropriate or unacceptable behaviour, without going into any details. Then over the weekend, the Sunday Times published a story, and it appears that the Sunday Times had gone to Welcome to Yorkshire and Gary Verity with, you know, with their story on, you would imagine, Friday. This is how the Sunday papers work, just before close of play on Friday, offering them the chance to comment and respond. Their story was, I suppose, they were scooped by Welcome to Yorkshire, who put out the same, and Gary Verity resigned more or less immediately, it seems. And a few things have come out of it that we didn't know. I mean, it appears that Gary Verity was given a sort of final warning in 2017 for some of his behaviour, and the expenses, the question over expenses remains a little bit murky. We don't really know too many details about that. But it's been said that he will repay what he owes to Welcome to Yorkshire. So the organisation, Welcome to Yorkshire, in a bit of flux on the, well, a few weeks out of the, from the Tour de Yorkshire. And it's created a lot of uncertainty in Yorkshire, which has become a sort of unofficial home of cycling in the UK, certainly cycling events. And some of the fallout already from this news is that there are questions about just how many public funds are awarded to events like the Tour of Yorkshire. So it could have ramifications for that event and for cycling more generally in Yorkshire. I mean, one or two quite troubling claims and allegations made. But it's an interesting one, this, because I suppose we all came into contact with Verity in the run-up to 2014, and just the way that he courted the Tour de France and Christian Prudhomme, it was very different to the way that Prudhomme and ASO were courted by Event Scotland, who were trying to bring the Tour de France to Yorkshire, to Edinburgh for the start. And Event Scotland, who were responsible for that bid, are a sort of government agency, so they're fully publicly funded and transparent. Welcome to Yorkshire is a limited company which relies on public funding, a lot of public funding, but also private money. And it's sort of not quite held to the same standard of accountability, I think, when it comes to money going in and going out. So what did we make of this story, chaps?
Well, I think the big concern is that although it's been a phenomenal success, cycling in Yorkshire since the Tour de France was there in 2014, it's been very much identified, probably wrongly, because there are an awful lot of people that we know, very good people, who have done an awful lot of hard work to build the region's reputation as a cycling destination. But it's been very much identified with one person, and that is Gary Verity. And that also applies to, I think, the general public's perception of those events. They're used to seeing Gary Verity on their TVs when the race comes around, We've certainly become very used to seeing him at races, not just the Tour de Yorkshire, but the Tour de France. He's often attended other races. And so it will be interesting to hear, and not much detail has come out yet, about how Yorkshire and Welcome to Yorkshire plan to rebuild and take this forward. The teams have been announced for the men's tour, well, and the women's Tour de Yorkshire today, and the number of World Tour teams at the event this year is down. There are only going to be 4 World Tour teams, and what you hope won't happen is that the event loses momentum. And you know, we've heard rumours, more or less substantiated, about all sorts of grand plans that Yorkshire has had for cycling going beyond the World Championships this year. It's talk of a Vuelta start and maybe other things, the Tour de France going back there possibly. And one would hope that it doesn't all turn to cinder now.
Yeah, there's a very interesting blog written by Susan Briggs. The full website address is tourismknowhow.com/issues/welcome-to-Yorkshire. It's really worth a read. Somebody who clearly knows a lot about the work that Welcome to Yorkshire has been doing over the last few years, and raises some really interesting questions about the relationship, Rich, you're talking about between a private company and public funds. Because one of the things that strikes me about regions or countries paying to bring bike races is that a lot of that money does come from the public purse, and so therefore there's a basic requirement for a level of transparency and a level of accountability. And so this is sort of shedding light on certain things about Welcome to Yorkshire that have happened under Gary Verity's on his watch, really. And some of the figures are quite incredible, such as £750,000 loss on unsold Tour de France merchandise from 2014. Now, this was reported at the time by Cycling Weekly. It's one of the reasons why Welcome to Yorkshire recorded a loss of £1 million the year after the Tour de France started in Yorkshire in 2014. But of course, you know, if those losses can be absorbed, the company goes on. And I think there's the relationship between the public money coming in, how much of that then effectively just gets paid on to, whether it be ASO or the UCI, in order to bring the events in. It's then about the relationship between that investment, if you like, or that expenditure, and the amount of money it attracts into the region. I mean, that's the whole point of doing it. But somewhere along the line, you know, the kind of the things get a little bit opaque, and the public facing bit, the crowds that turn out for the race give it an impression that it's been tremendously successful, and kind of no questions asked while it's going on. But clearly there were questions to be asked.
It's interesting because it's an organisation with turnover 4 million, so £1 million loss is a very substantial loss. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, if you look at some of the reaction to this, there's been a lot of reaction in Yorkshire itself, including from people who clearly know quite a lot about the organisation and how it's worked. But from cycling fans, an awful lot of people very sad to see the departure of Gary Verity, because no question, as you say, Daniel, he's been very identified with putting Yorkshire on the map in a cycling sense, and creating a great event, putting on a great Grand Départ, bringing the World Championships to the UK for the first time since 1982, in partnership with other bodies as well, of course. But you know, you do need, it's difficult, isn't it, because it does need to be accountable, and you know, especially when you're talking about public money, there needs to be a benefit from that. But it also requires a salesperson, you know, to sell the vision and have the imagination that someone like Gary Verity had. And you know, those images we had of Yorkshire for that Grand Départ weekend are incredibly powerful, I would think, certainly to a cycling audience, but to a non-cycling audience as well.
And would it be fair to say as well, chaps, that this comes at a bad time, in the sense that the British public, given the political situation, is very, very sensitised to anything to do with where public money is going at this particular time, more than ever?
I would say so. And also, you know, it's another kind of indirect blow to cycling as well, isn't it? Which has trouble with credibility. You know, all of the stories about Team Sky's conduct, the fact that, you know, the Dr. Richard Freeman case is ongoing, and, you know, a resolution to that is, you know, has been pushed into the sort of middle distance. It's another kind of story on the bigger stage that doesn't make cycling look too great, does it?
Well, Tour of Yorkshire is going to be an interesting event, isn't it? Because this is a part of the backdrop. We've also got the launch of Team Ineos. And, you know, since we spoke about Team Ineos last week, Team Sky becoming Ineos, and actually, you know, we'd got the press release confirming that literally at more or less as we pressed record on our recorders. So we were responding to the immediate news. And I think over the 24 hours or so, after that, there was quite a lot of reaction to the business of the company Ineos in particular, and suggestions that there will be perhaps protests at the Tour of Yorkshire. So, you know, it could be a very interesting occasion that, from having been just a celebration of cycling in Yorkshire, the backdrop at this year's race will be uncertainty over the future, the scandal around the departure of Guy Verity, and perhaps more will come out about that in the next few weeks, and Team Ineos. And the debut of Team Ineos, and the fact that, you know, fracking goes on not far from where the race will be starting, that there could well be protests and so on.
Rich, I think your point that you made while we were having lunch about you know, Ineos and the reaction, again, you know, we don't have the same sort of reaction to some people do, but there isn't the same hoo-ha about Bahrain sponsorship of Bahrain Merida, for example. And, you know, you only have to look at the Amnesty International website to have a look at Bahrain's kind of record on human rights and so on. But Richard, you know, you mentioned that Team Sky, their pass on plastics and the ocean initiative with the whale logo on the Tour de France jersey was, from some people, greeted with some cynicism and kind of ridicule almost as a sort of...
Yeah, I don't remember people really getting, or certainly some cycling fans getting behind that. And yet that's been used now to as a way of revealing the hypocrisy of Team Sky / Team Ineos. But I would say it's revealing of some other people's hypocrisy too, because you know, to use that as a stick to beat them with does reek of hypocrisy a bit. But there is I think the thing is, we have to try and be consistent, you know, I know that's very difficult, and we've had this conversation, and it's the subject is fascinating, because it is a growing concern in sport and in football certainly, and in cycling as well now, of companies using sport to, as you say, greenwash. There's a similar debate happening in the arts, you know, there was a very interesting debate on the radio this morning in the UK about the Sackler Trust. They're the family, the American family behind, well, blamed for the opioid crisis in the US, huge donors to good causes, including the arts, and the National Portrait Gallery in the UK has just rejected a grant from the Sackler Trust. And there was a debate about, you know, whether the arts should accept money from, in inverted commas, disreputable organizations. What's the solution to that? At what point do you take the moral high ground and say, no, we don't want your money? I mean, you're a football fan, Lionel. If you're a club, Watford, do you care where the money comes from?
Well, that's completely different, because I am a fan of a club. And
yeah, that's an interesting point of view, though, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. There isn't the same debate going on to perhaps the same extent in football about Abu Dhabi's ownership of Manchester City,
people,
for example.
Have very, very high moral expectations of cycling, don't they? More than they do about football.
But is that not because of the types of people who are more likely to be interested in a sport possibly, like cycling? Yeah. People who are kind of outward looking and, you know, consider more than perhaps, you know, one or two.
There isn't the same level of partisan support. People tend to be fans of the sport, supporters of the sport, rather than supporters of an entity within the sport.
And yet Team Sky has been probably the first team to sort of buck that trend outside of perhaps the kind of the Belgian heartland, where you do see people who are Quickstep supporters or whatever. It's a real fascinating...
You go back through the history of sponsorships in cycling, and it's, you know, whether it's liquid gas or adhesives or cement or, you know, floor or grout, or, you know, just floor laminate. None of these products are particularly environmentally friendly, but we all use them. We're all complicit in that sense.
Again, though, I think it's possible to drink out of a plastic bottle and burn fuel in your car. I mean, we burn a lot of fuel driving around covering the Grand Tours. It is possible to go about your everyday business using the apparatus of modern life with a conscience, you know, with an awareness. It's possible to kind of do those things and yet have a view on, you know, a company like Ineos and you know, looking at its record and how it makes its money, considerable money, and particularly, you know, there, you know, it is possible to say, well, I'm okay with burning petrol in a car, but I'm actually not okay with fracking. That's okay. People are allowed to do that.
And it's an interesting moment because, you know, Team Sky have been a divisive team just through their performances on the road and questions around their ethics and so on. Now having a sponsor like this puts them more in the firing line, if you like, and makes them perhaps more of a focus for...
It would be interesting to know what conversations, whether any conversations to that effect took place. You know, we understand that Ineos weren't the only option on the table. I don't know how far negotiations went with other parties, but I suspect that Sky went with the partner who was willing to invest for the longest amount of time and the most amount of money. I don't imagine there was a brainstorming session where they decided, well, this sponsor is going to make us look like a 7 out of 10 ethically, and this one is going to make us look like a 2 out of 10.
I think that's the bottom line, isn't it? In professional sport, where the money that pours in tends to pour into quite a small number of pockets, whether you're talking about football or cycling or any other sport, really, when it comes down to it, money, the source of the money is, as long as it's legal, as long as it's within the rules, and let's remind everyone, there are no rules regarding a petrochemical company sponsoring a race or a team or whatever, and there are no rules against Bahrain sponsoring a team, clearly. So when it comes down to it, unless there is a rule that the sport agrees on, and I, to be honest, that they would struggle to enforce such a rule if the behaviour is, you know, legal, the company is legal, then it's legally entitled and to sponsor a team. I mean, it would require quite a number of steps to get to a position where cycling would be in any position to turn away that kind of investment from that sort of company.
Shall we leave it there, fellas? Some more racing this weekend. I'm off, actually, to E3 on Thursday and Gent-Wevelgem on Sunday, so I shall report back from those races next week. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.